talk about is, as David said, the algorithm for the shortest path through time, but really it's this is just one of the outcomes of some research, and that it's basically about the direction of time, and the universe has a... Has that got a bit of an echo on it? Yeah. And so what I'm going to show is that the universe has this quantum algorithm, well, that's what I'm proposing, that and by interference we end up with going through time in the shortest path, well, in our case it's to the future, okay?
In our case?
Well, I mean, I guess the idea is that the future is whatever we define as where we're heading, in a sense. But, well, there are two paths, to the future and to the past. Now, by way of introduction, I'd like to talk about two fundamental problems. The first one is, what is the origin of the direction of time? Now, if you're thinking about the origin of direction of time, you naturally think about the beginning of the universe and the energy density of the Big Bang and so on. So high that we need to use quantum gravity in order to describe it. And then a natural thing to look at, I mean, there's a number of different approaches to quantum gravity, but a natural one is to look at the canonical approach and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And there you find that due to what Misner called topological invariance, the Hamiltonian constraint is that the universe should be in an eigenstate, zero eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian includes the gravitational field as well as matter fields. Okay, now the topological invariance means that physical predictions of the theory aren't changed by different choices of topologically equivalent space-time manifolds. Okay, if you just redefine where the space-time manifolds are, then, redefine this, hypersurfaces, space-like hypersurfaces, your predictions shouldn't change. And this will show that that means that the Hamiltonian must be in a, well, the state of the universe must be in a zero eigenstate of Hamiltonian. Now, psi here in this solution represents the whole history of the universe, being interpreted as the whole history of the universe. There's no preference for either direction of time. People say it doesn't have time at all. You can use a WKB approximation to impose a time-like structure on it related to an expansion parameter. This is typically how it's done. The scalar parameter. And so you can add by an ad hoc method, put in a classical time variable. Okay, but then you lose the quantum features that you must have at the early part of the history of the universe. So other theories, the notion of time is even less clear than this. So it doesn't help us too much working out the direction of time, because if you can't get anything relating to time out of it, it's directionless, right? Or it's just the history with no specific direction. Then if you look at the classical theory of space-time, general relativity, it assumes that the evolution is in a fixed direction. So, for example, this is a Friedman-Robinson-Walker universe, the scale parameter, which is increased. So, and our epoch, we look into the past and we see the Big Bang has occurred. Now, the big questions are, how do you go from quantum gravity, where it's no time, or it certainly doesn't have a specific direction of evolution, to a classical theory of general relativity where it's presumed that the evolution occurs in one direction of time? So that's a big question, and a number of approaches to try and answer it. They're all rather ad hoc. The other thing is that the solutions in general relativity, so that Friedman, Robinson, Walker universe, they can take place where you can describe solutions for positive t as well as negative t. And you might think this is just a trivial symmetry here, that if you're in this part of the universe and our evolution is in the positive t direction, you would see the Big Bang as occurring in our past. And likewise, if you're in this part of the solution and evolution was occurring along the negative t axis, you would see the Big Bang in the in your past as well. That might just seem like a very trivial question to ask, you know. And you might think that these two directions of time aren't distinguishable. Well, for a lot of phenomena, they are distinguishable, but they can be distinguished. Okay, so that's one of the things I'll be talking about, and the fact that these two different directions and two solutions of the Friedman Robinson Walker universe model is are distinguishable. So, if that's the case, if they are distinguishable, then how does the universe know which direction to pick? Because we seem to be on one of these, we don't seem to be on both. So how does the universe know which one of these two directions to pick? Is there some kind of spontaneous symmetry breaker? And that's what I'll be trying to answer. I'll be trying to show you, convince you, that there is a kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and I'll show the mechanism for it. And this is the direction of time problem. Okay, so what people normally do to analyze this is they look for arrows of time. So this began with Eddington, who coined the phrase in 1928. So the most commonly discussed one is the thermodynamic arrow. There's also the cosmological arrow, electromagnetic, psychological, and others. Okay, and the thermodynamic obviously points in the direction of increasing entropy. Cosmological is in the direction of increase in the size of the universe, etc. There's also this matter-antimatter arrow, which is based upon CP violation and accounts for the fact that there's an abundance of, it's to do with the fact that there's an abundance of matter over antimatter. But it's a bit of a mystery. These ones, the first set of arrows can be tied together. They seem to be linked. But this last one here is a mystery. And it's the one that I want to try and incorporate in a physical theory of time. The first set relies on time symmetric dynamics. Now, thermodynamics is based upon time symmetric laws of motion and things like that. And the cosmological one is, as I've already spoken about, the general relativity is time symmetric. If you look at these arrows in these different directions of time, you find that the thermodynamic arrow increases along the positive x-axis. If the universe, you know, this is the Big Bang here, and the universe is expanding, the cosmological arrow will be pointing in this direction. They all point in the same direction, but if you look at this solution, you find that they point in the opposite direction, okay? The direction that you suppose that evolution is taking place. So they're not really, in a sense, objective. They don't tell us which one of these two branches, you know, which branch that we're on. They don't distinguish between the two. It's quite different with the matter-antimatter arrow. Okay, so the only possibility of breaking the symmetry is with the antimatter arrow, matter-antimatter arrow, and it's actually, well, as I said, these rely on time-symmetric dynamics. The matter-antimatter is time-asymmetric dynamics. It's the only one with a dynamical law, which is time-asymmetric. All these are associated, they're basically boundary conditions, asymmetric boundary conditions, or statistics, they're based upon time-symmetric laws. So the matter-antimatter is the only one that's a dynamical law. So is there something very special about it? And it's the one that we should look for breaking the symmetry in time. So in order to discuss this particular arrow, let's look at the time reversal operator. So this is the one that was introduced by Wigner. It's an anti-unitary operator, and I've got a tremor going here. We don't have to evacuate, there's no alarms. Can you see the screen was moving? basically what this operator does is that it takes the momenta and inverts their sign. So here's linear momentum, it just changes the sign of that, and for angular momentum, spin, it reverses the sign of that. But it's an anti-unitary operator, and one part, this part here, this K, is acts as the complex conjugation. Okay, and so we take a typical Schrodinger equation for some system, and we apply this time reversal operation to it. When the time reversal operation applies on the left-hand side here, it changes the minus I into an I and acts on the state. When it acts on the Hamiltonian, well, time symmetric systems, the Hamiltonian is unchanged, and so we end up with this equation here. What that means is that if we regard this as the forward direction, this is pink line here, then we apply this time reversal operation, what happens is the momentum's change, and things go back to where they were, right? Things just reverse, and they go back. So if you keep following the evolution, you just backtrack what you had here. And so this point here is equivalent to that point there. And Wigner calls this pushing this system back in time. But of course, you're not going back in time. But you can imagine that it's actually tracing out this path here, backwards. But kaons, this kinesons, don't behave this way. So this was discovered in 1964 by Cronin and Fitch and co-workers. Partially accounts for the observed dominance of matter over antimatter. But more recently, there's been direct T violations, CP violations, charge parity conjugation, symmetry, and under the CPT theorem, that a violation of CP is also a violation of T. Well, direct, so there was an implicit T violation in their experiment, but even now, in the last 10 years or so, there's been observation of direct T violation and K-meson decay. And that's looking at these neutral K-mesons and their antiparticles and comparing. Okay, so it's independent of the CPT invariants. Okay, so we have this growing evidence that there is a T violation. Now, what this means is that the time-reversed Hamiltonian is not the same as the original Hamiltonian. So if you have some motion that you're following in time, you apply the time reversal operator, you don't unravel it, you don't backtrack, you go somewhere else, which means that you, if you were thinking about going back in time, well, you wouldn't go back. Okay, so that's just applying the time reversal operator. What it means is that we need a different Hamiltonian to go backwards in time. Okay, so naturally to bring this dotted line here back along here, we use this Hamiltonian and not the H. Okay, it's the time reverse Hamiltonian to backtrack. So if you go forwards, if you go in one direction, evolution in one direction is one Hamiltonian, evolution in the opposite direction will require a different Hamiltonian. Now, I think Hugh's here somewhere. So I'm challenging, it's not so much a challenge. I hope I've got this right, that Hugh has said that the concept of an objective directive of time is not incoherent in itself. But there's a lack of evidence that proponents of the idea that there is a particular objective direction of time haven't provided sufficient evidence for it. And I agree with that. But even this violation of time reversal invariance is not in itself enough to say that there's a particular direction, a singular one direction. Okay, because the events, they're relatively rare. They occur in mesons. The magnitudes are very small. The variation is like 0.3%. Experiments, and no large-scale effects have been shown. If it was the large-scale effects that affect our daily lives, then you'd say, yes, it perhaps is. You can get something from it. And that's what I actually want to show. So I want to provide that evidence that the T-violation processes can have large-scale physical effects and can actually determine the direction of time. So this is a new bit of evidence. Okay, so now that was the first problem about the direction, the origin of the direction of time. The second problem is, now that we know that the universe violates time reversal invariance, it means that there are two Hamiltonians. Now, as the universe as a whole, we don't know the direction of time for it. I mean, you don't have an external reference for saying time goes in one direction, so we should pick one Hamiltonian. So which Hamiltonian do we pick? Well, there's no basis for picking either Hamiltonian. Okay, so our current theory is that what you have to do is pick a direction of time and a version of the Hamiltonian, and you write down the Schrödinger equation, and then to see if the Hamiltonian is not time reversal invariant, then you apply the time reversal operation to get the evolution in the opposite direction of time. Okay, so just by relabeling the state here, we get the Schrödinger equation for the opposite direction of time, but with a different Hamiltonian. But we don't have a dynamical equation that involves both Hamiltonians, where we don't know the direction of time. And the universe as a whole, we don't have a specific direction. We can take one from our own position in the universe and say, well, time is going in a particular direction, I do experiments, I find the Hamiltonian associated with kaon decay, and I use that one. Okay, but that's a very local picture. If we want to consider the universe as a whole, we can't make that choice. Okay, so there's no satisfactory conformalism for describing the universe that exhibits T violation. You have to put in by hand that the time has a particular direction. So the way I'm going to answer this, these two problems, is that I'm going to take, there's no a priori direction of time evolution in the universe, so we must allow for both directions of time, and that means we're going to have multiple paths through time. Okay, now, in order to try and put all this together, I'm going to use Feynman's sum of the histories method. So Feynman's idea is that if you want to go from a state A to state B, state A at one time to state B at a different time, then you can write the transition amplitude for that as a sum over all possible paths between those two states. Okay, so the total transition amplitude from A to B is a sum of all the amplitudes of all possible paths from A to B. Well, I'm going to use exactly the same method. I'm going to use this as a tool for building up theory. So the model of the universe is closed in the sense that it doesn't interact with any other physical system. It has no external clocks, so the analysis needs to be unbiased with respect to direction of time. And both versions of the Hamiltonian should appear in the dynamical equation of motion. Okay, so the first step is to look at evolution corresponding to what I would say is, I'm going to call forwards and backwards, but of course there's no particular meaning to that, no specific meaning to what forwards and backwards are, just opposite directions. So if we take a particular state and we evolve it over a time interval tau in one direction of time called forwards, then it would evolve like this, the unitary time operator, and with this Hamiltonian here, which is the Hamiltonian for that particular direction of time. Okay, in the backwards direction, well, it would be a unitary time evolution operator from the same initial state, same starting state. It would be this Hamiltonian here would be the time reversed Hamiltonian for the opposite direction of time. And notice that there's a plus here rather than a minus. So it's in the opposite sense, evolving in the opposite sense. And this unitary operator here, UB, is just the time reversed version of UF, okay? Just under weakness, time reversal operator. Now to construct this paths. So you can say that this matrix element going from psi naught to phi via this forward evolution operator is an amplitude to go from phi to psi. And here, this matrix element is likewise an amplitude to go from psi to phi via this different Hamiltonian. Okay, so they're amplitudes to go from one state to another, and they're the same states in both cases, but they're different Hamiltonians. Okay, so that's two different paths in time. So that's how I'm interpreting it. There's two different paths in time, and the amplitude from going between two states. Now, according to Feynman, we've got amplitudes for two different paths. We've got no way of favoring one path over the other, so we should just add the amplitudes. Okay, so I'm going from state psi to state phi by two different paths, and I'm just sum those amplitudes. These are probability amplitudes, and I just sum them. Okay, so here's the total amplitude from going from psi to phi. It's just the sum of those amplitudes, which you can write down as the sum of these two unitary operators. If you sum two unitary operators, you don't get a unitary operator. So now I'm losing normalization of the states, but that doesn't really matter. Okay, so now I have, this is the total amplitude. Now, this is true for all states. So what I can say is that the initial state psi, if I evolve ambiguously along these two paths, then the final state will be this. Okay, so it's for all states phi here. So it must be true that we end up, and this part of the equation here is some new state. Which is this thing here, okay? So I'm calling this the time-symmetric evolution. So it's not evolution in one particular direction of time, but in both simultaneously. Okay, so the idea is something like this. So it's a little bit like a double slit, you add amplitudes. Now, if you look at the evolution of this state that we got to for another period of ambiguous direction of time, then you would start with that. So here is the state, and I apply this part to it again, and I end up with the original state size with this operator squared. If I do that n times, then it's just this operator to the nth power. Now, what that means is that this is a binomial term here, and it's really a binomial, what I'm doing here, so this is going two different paths here, and I'm breaking this point here into two further paths, and so on. So we end up with a binary tree. So this is one step in the forwards, one step in the backwards, this step to the forwards here, you can also go backwards one step and forwards one step, and so on. Now, so it's really like Feynman's path integral, okay, going through all paths in time in this case, forwards and backwards. Now this is the state that you get after this evolution. It's made up of a sum of all these terms. Now, if you look at this term here, there's four, it involves four operations, only one is forward. So I'm writing it this way with this notation. Capital N is the total number of steps, and M is the number of forward evolutions. So you can get to that point by going forwards once and three times backwards once, forwards once, and two times backwards, etc. So it's a sum of terms. Well, it's actually a sum of terms containing this binomial coefficient here, Nm, of different terms. And then all the different orderings of M forward steps and N minus M backward steps. Okay, so if you look at the matrix elements of this, psi between psi and phi, it's a sum over a set of paths, each comprising n forward steps and n minus n backward steps. Now, I just put in this, the length of the time step is tau. The first thing to consider is let's make that as short as possible. Let's take a limit. And the way to look at the limit that tau goes to zero is just take a fixed total time, where the total time is n, so capital N steps of tau. So tau then becomes the total time divided by n, and we take the limit as n goes to infinity. And you find that this term that we have in our, this binomial term that we have in our expressions, if you look at that, as n goes to infinity, tau gets very small, it turns out to be in the limit, it becomes just the difference between the two Hamiltonians. Excuse me. So what this means is that if you have a clock, a normal clock device that we construct, you know, using the harmonic oscillators, that it would be using a Hamiltonian, which is time reverse and invariant. Now, if it's time reverse and invariant, these two Hamiltonians will be equal, and so it won't be evolving at all. And that seems like an satisfactory result. So the argument is that we should set tau to be a small time interval, okay, that it cannot go to zero. So I'm going to set it to the Planck time as being a suitably small time interval. I just know that I don't get reasonable results if it goes to infinity. Having time being a discrete quantity is something that people in loop quantum gravity and various forms of quantum gravity find they look for solutions where you are forced to have a discrete space-time structure. Okay, so in loop quantum gravity, that's one of the triumphs is to find that loop quantum gravity requires a discrete structure to space-time. So it's not something that is a problem. It's something it's actually a useful quantity, a useful result. Now, so we've got multiple paths, and of course you'd expect to get interference. So if you look at this path here, so there's four steps, but involving just a single forward step. Okay, so there are a number of different ways to get to that point. First one forward, three backwards, one backwards, etc. Okay, so there are four terms there that interfere. I'm going to look at that. So in order to do this, what I want to do is rearrange this. So this is the expression we had before, this this sum raised to the power of n, and I'm writing it in terms of this operator here, which has got n ufs and the remainder are ubs. Okay, they're all different orderings. And what I want to do is write it like this, where I've got all the ubs, or the backward evolution operators, to the left, and all the forward evolution operators to the right. And I can do that, I can swap the order of these things, but when I do that, I have to take account of the commutator, okay, between the Hamiltonians. So just the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula, if you interchange the order of expressions like this, you have to take into account this commutator. So when I do that and I get the rearrange all these things, I find I have this additional term here, which is involves the commutator between the forward and backwards Hamiltonians. Okay, this is interference term. This is where we get interference. Now, it's hard to work this through this in terms of operators, so I want to transform it into something with numbers. So I'll use the eigenbasis of the commutator. So the commutator has an eigenvalue equation, and I'm going to express this term here in terms of these eigenvalues. Now, you get a resolution of the identity, and there will be this eigenbasis. There will be a trace one projection operator projecting onto lambda, an eigenvalue of lambda, and this is the degeneracy of that eigenvalue. Rho is the degeneracy. Okay, so when you do that, so this is the identity operator. I just apply the identity operator here and write this in terms of these lambdas. Then I get this S operator written like this. So I've got the right ordering of these unitary time evolution operators, and then this expression here. Okay, so you get two parts. One is the degeneracy of the eigenvalues, and then there's this interference term. That interference term is really like a diffraction grating, product of many diffraction gratings. It's actually an interference term. You find it when you look at diffraction gratings. Okay, this degeneracy of the eigenvalues, well, to find out what they are, I'm using a phenomenological model by Lee and Wolfenstein from 65. It's still used. This model still appears in particle physics. It's the standard model, the phenomenological, empirical, getting results from experiments. For a single KR, it's a two-state system, and you just simply go through and find out what the commutator is for this. And what I find is that for a single kaon, the eigenvalues are plus or minus 10 to the 17 per second squared. Well, this is when h bar is equal to 1, so you should multiply this by h bar squared. Okay, if you take the square root of this eigenvalue, you get energy. I mean, the commutator has got units of energy squared. You take the square root, you get energy. And so the square root of this, if you work out what it is, it's about a micro electron volt. Now, the kaons have a mass of about 500 MeV. So this violation, this difference between forwards and backwards, is a micro electron volt. So it's really quite small. But that's not really a problem. If you consider that there are, say, n kaons in the system, in the universe, then the standard deviation of this width of this degeneracy function will be the square root of n times this number. Now, I need to get some kind of handle on n, and I'm going to say that it's a fraction of the total number of particles in the system, this universe. So 10 to the 8 is the total number of particles, so f is just some fraction, and m is this f times 10 to the 80. Okay, so when you see f, that's what it represents, some fraction. You can put any number you like there. It doesn't really matter. All I really want to show is the principle that we get interference. Okay, now looking at this other term, so we've just looked at this degeneracy here, and that's this curve here. Okay, it's a binomial distribution. Now looking at this interference term here, it has, well, they're different regimes. It can be quite broad or it can be narrow. Now the width of that term is given by this thing here. It's you can see that on the denominator here, we've got m times m minus n times n. Now, to make this very narrow, okay, in this extreme here, what we need is a big number on the denominator. And that occurs when the number of forward steps equals the number of backward steps. Okay, so when you've got zigzagging kind of evolution, going forwards and backwards, then it would be very narrow. Alternatively, there are situations where it can be quite broad. Okay, you get a small number on the bottom here, we're going mostly forwards or mostly backwards, and then it'll be quite broad. Now, in those two extremes, this is just a function here. When it's really broad, you can replace it approximately with unity, and that means that you've just got this resolution of the identity here. Okay, that means it's no interference. Now, in the other extreme where it's very narrow, this part here of the integral is the resolution of the identity. If this is very narrow, it's cutting out the resolution of the identity, cutting into it, and so it reduces it from being the identity to something else, and that means that it's destructive interference. So when we've got equal numbers of forwards and backwards steps, we get a lot of interference. When we're going mostly forwards or mostly backwards, we don't get much interference. Okay, so what that means is when you put numbers on this, that the total time, the number of steps times the Planck time, is a lot greater than this, 10 to the minus 13 seconds times the square root, 1 over the square root of that fraction of the total number of particles. So there is some regime where this will happen. You only ever have two paths that survive. All the others will be destroyed by destructive interference. Okay, so where there's an equal number of steps, as in the middle here, or forwards and backwards, that's totally destructively interfering, but going continuously forwards or continuously backwards, that's fine. So coming from something where I'm saying that there's no direction of time, now I have a situation where you either go continuously forwards or continuously backwards. Well, that's quite a bizarre result. And it's come about by this asymmetry. And violation of time reverse invariance. Okay, so instead of being where's this expression? Instead of being the expression like this, where there is I haven't put in the interference, the effect of interference, which is the sum of these two things raised to the nth power, I now get, because of this interference, that the system evolves in a superposition of going forwards, so this is n steps, this is n steps backwards, and a superposition with n steps forwards. Okay, so from that you get a Schrodinger equation here, going forwards, and the Schrodinger equation going backwards, two different Hamiltonians. Now, I said before that there's these different models, different solutions, to the Friedman, Robinson, Walker universe, that if we were in this branch, is different from that branch. Well, these two paths here correspond to those two different branches. And what you find here is that there's a particular Hamiltonian. It's the forward version of the Hamiltonian. And we find that by doing these experiments, these Adam-Smash experiments, and you find evidence, this comes out of the experiments, what the terms in the Hamiltonian are. Okay, and that's different. If we were on this branch, we'd find a different Hamiltonian. These are very distinctive things. You take, distinctively different. And that means that these two different paths are different. Okay, so here you would see the Big Bang in your past, but you measure a different Hamiltonian, so they are distinguishable. And this is like spontaneous symmetry breaking. The whole system itself is symmetrical in time, but by looking at observations around us, we find that we're on this branch rather than that branch. So this is a symmetry breaking. Okay, so we're on one of these branches. And I'm using the many worlds interpretation. So basically, is that because of the interference, rather than taking random paths through time, we're actually taking the shortest path. Now, if I just... there's another part to this. Do I have any time at all? If you look at the early universe, there wouldn't have been T violation at all. Different models, like a hot universe, it would be radiation dominated, there'd be no T violation. If you look at this expression, where the two Hamiltonians are equal, what you find is that it's just like the power method of finding the dominant eigenvalue We're just taking an operator here and we're raising it to the power, a high power. As you increase that power, what you find is the state becomes the state corresponding to the largest eigenvalue. The largest eigenvalue of this expression is the eigenvalue of H, which is zero. Okay, which means that we end up in a state which is of zero eigenvalue of H, which is the Hamiltonian constraint of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So this is kind of funny that we have this topological invariance coming out of it automatically. And just to finish off, so these two problems that I mentioned, the dynamical equation of two Hamiltonians, I've built that up by using Feynman's sum over histories and being unbiased about how I incorporate those two Hamiltonians. And the origin of the direction of time, well, it's by this interference, destructive interference, that you get to these two paths. And you get physical evidence that shows which path we're on. And I've just shown that you get the algorithm from the shortest path to the future. Thank you.